exacerbated by the death of her brother, Ben, to whom she was very close. He was killed in a motorcycle accident when he was 19 and she 15. She ran away from home 3 days after his funeral. She was arrested twice, once for theft and once for soliciting. Her relationship with her parents, the mail informs me, broke down completely. Both her parents died a few years ago, without ever being reconciled with their daughter. Reading this, I feel desperately sad for Megan. I realise that perhaps, after all, she isn't so different from me. She's isolated and lonely too. When she was 16, she moved in with a boyfriend who had a house near the village of Holcombe in North Norfolk. The school friend says he was an older guy, a musician or something. He was into drugs. We didn't see Megan much after they got together. The boyfriend's name is not given, so presumably they haven't found him. He might not even exist. The school friend might be making this stuff up just to get her name into the papers. They skip forward several years after that. Suddenly, Megan is 24, living in London, working as a waitress in a North London restaurant. There, she meets Scott Hipwell, an independent IT contractor who is friendly with the restaurant manager, and the two of them hit it off. After an intense courtship, Megan and Scott marry, when she is 26 and he is 30. There are a few other quotes, including one from Tara Epstein, the friend with whom Megan was supposed to stay on the night she disappeared. She says that Megan is a lovely, carefree girl, and that she seemed very happy. Scott would not have hurt her, Tara says. He loves her very much. There isn't a thing Tara says that isn't a cliché. The quote that interests me is from one of the artists who exhibited their work in the gallery Megan used to manage, one Rajesh Gujral, who says that Megan is a wonderful woman, sharp, funny and beautiful, an intensely private person with a warm heart. Sounds to me like Rajesh has got a crush. The only other quote comes from a man called David Clark, a former colleague of Scott's, who says, "Megs and Scott are a great couple. They're very happy together, very much in love." There are some news pieces about the investigation too, but the statements from the police amount to less than nothing. They have spoken to a number of witnesses. They are pursuing several lines of inquiry. The only interesting comment comes from Detective Inspector Gaskill, who confirms that two men are helping the police with their inquiries. I'm pretty sure that means they're both suspects. One will be Scott. Could the other be B? Could B be Rajesh? I've been so engrossed in the newspapers that I haven't been paying my usual attention to the journey. It seems as though I've only just sat down when the train grinds to its customary halt opposite the red signal. There are people in Scott's garden. There are two uniformed police just outside the back door. My head swims. Have they found something? Have they found her? Is there a body buried in the garden or shoved under the floorboards? I can't stop thinking of the clothes on the side of the railway line, which is stupid, because I saw those there before Megan went missing. And, in any case, if harm has been done to her, it wasn't by Scott. It can't have been. He's madly in love with her. Everyone says so. The light is bad today. The weather's turned. The sky leaden, threatening. I can't see into the house. I can't see what's going on. I feel quite desperate. I cannot stand being on the outside. For better or worse, I am a part of this now. I need to know what's going on. At least I have a plan. First, I need to find out if there's any way that I can be made to remember what happened on Saturday night. When I get to the library, I plan to do some research and find out whether hypnotherapy could make me remember, whether it is in fact possible to recover that lost time. Second, and I reckon this is important, because I don't think the police believed me when I told them about Megan's lover, I need to get in touch with Scott Hipwell. I need to tell him. He deserves to know. Evening. The train is full of rain-soaked people, steam rising off their clothes and condensing on the windows. The fug of body odour, perfume and laundry soap hangs oppressively above bowed, damp heads. The clouds that menaced this morning did so all day, growing heavier and blacker until they burst monsoon-like this evening, just as office workers stepped outside and the rush hour began in earnest, leaving the roads gridlocked and tube station entrances choked with people opening and closing umbrellas. I don't have an umbrella, and am soaked through. I feel as though someone has thrown a bucket of water over me. My cotton trousers cling to my thighs, and my faded blue shirt has become embarrassingly transparent. I ran all the way from the library to the tube station, with my handbag clutched against my chest, to hide what I could. For some reason, I found this funny. There is something ridiculous about being caught in the rain, and I was laughing so hard by the time I got to the top of Gray's Inn Road, I could barely breathe. I can't remember the last time I laughed like that. I'm not laughing now. As soon as I got myself a seat, I checked the latest on Megan's case on my phone, and it's the news I've been dreading. A 35-year-old man is being questioned under caution at Whitney Police Station regarding the disappearance of Megan Hipwell, missing from her home since Saturday evening. That's Scott. I'm sure of it. I can only hope that he read my email before they picked him up, because questioning under caution is serious. It means they think he did it. Although, of course, it is yet to be defined. It may not have happened at all. Megan might be fine. Every now and again it does strike me that she's alive and well and sitting on a hotel balcony with a view of the sea, her feet up on the railings, a cold drink at her elbow. The thought of her there both thrills and disappoints me. And then I feel sick for feeling disappointed. I don't wish her ill, no matter how angry I was with her for cheating on Scott, for shattering my illusions about my perfect couple. No. It's because I feel like I'm part of this mystery. I'm connected. I am no longer just a girl on the train going back and forth without point or purpose. I want Megan to turn up safe and sound. I do. Just not quite yet. I sent Scott an email this morning. His address was easy to find. I googled him and found www.shipwellconsulting.co.uk, the site where he advertises a range of consultancy, cloud and web-based services for business and non-profit organisations. I knew it was him, because his business address is also his home address. I sent a short message to the contact given on the site. Dear Scott, my name is Rachel Watson. You don't know me. I would like to talk to you about your wife. I do not have any information on her whereabouts. I don't know what has happened to her. But I believe I have information that could help you. You may not want to talk to me. I would understand that. But if you do, email me on this address. Yours sincerely, Rachel. I don't know if he would have contacted me anyway. I doubt that I would, if I were in his shoes. Like the police, he'd probably just think I was a nutter. Some weirdo who's read about the case in the newspaper. Now, I'll never know. If he's been arrested, he may never get a chance to see the message. If he's been arrested, the only people who see it may be the police, which won't be good news for me. But I had to try. And now I feel desperate, thwarted. I can't see through the mob of people in the carriage across to their side of the tracks, my side. And even if I could, with the rain still pouring down, I wouldn't be able to see beyond the railway fence. I wonder whether evidence is being washed away, whether right at this moment vital clues are disappearing forever. Smears of blood, footprints, DNA-loaded cigarette butts. I want to drink so badly I can almost taste the wine on my tongue. I can imagine exactly what it will feel like for the alcohol to hit my bloodstream and make my head rush. I want a drink, and I don't want one, because if I don't have a drink today, then it'll be 3 days, and I can't remember the last time I stayed off for 3 days in a row. There's a taste of something else in my mouth, too. An old stubbornness. There was a time when I had willpower, when I could run 10K before breakfast and subsist for weeks on 1,300 calories a day. It was one of the things Tom loved about me, he said. My stubbornness. My strength. I remember an argument, right at the end, when things were about as bad as they could be. He lost his temper with me.
"What happened to you, Rachel?" he asked me. "When did you become so weak?"
I don't know. I don't know where that strength went. I don't remember losing it. I think that over time it got chipped away, bit by bit. By life. By the living of it. The train comes to an abrupt halt, brakes screeching alarmingly, at the signal on the London side of Whitney. The carriage is filled with murmured apologies as standing passengers stumble, bumping into each other, stepping on each other's feet. I look up and find myself looking right into the eyes of the man from Saturday night. The ginger one. The one who helped me up. He's staring right at me. His startlingly blue eyes locked on mine. And I get such a fright, I drop my phone. I retrieve it from the floor and look up again. Tentatively this time, not directly at him. I scan the carriage. I wipe the steamy window with my elbow and stare out. And then eventually, I look back over at him, and he smiles at me, his head cocked a little to one side. I can feel my face burning. I don't know how to react to his smile because I don't know what it means. Is it, "Oh, hello, I remember you from the other night"? Or is it, "Ah, it's that pissed girl who fell down the stairs and talked shit at me the other night"? Or is it something else? I don't know. But thinking about it now, I believe I have a snatch of soundtrack to go with the picture of me slipping on the steps. Him saying, "You all right, love?" I turn away and look out of the window again. I can feel his eyes on me. I just want to hide, to disappear. The train judders off, and in seconds we're pulling into Whitney Station, and people start jostling each other for position, folding newspapers and packing away Kindles and iPads as they prepare to disembark. I look up again, and am flooded with relief. He's turned away from me. He's getting off the train. It strikes me then that I'm being an idiot. I should get up and follow him, talk to him. He can tell me what happened, or what didn't happen. He might be able to fill in some of the blanks, at least. I get to my feet. I hesitate. I know it's already too late. The doors are about to close. I'm in the middle of the carriage. I won't be able to push my way through the crowd in time. The doors beep and close. Still standing, I turn and look out of the window as the train pulls away. He's standing on the edge of the platform in the rain. The man from Saturday night, watching me as I go past. The closer I get to home, the more irritated with myself I feel. I'm almost tempted to change trains at Northcote, go back to Whitney and look for him. A ridiculous idea, obviously, and stupidly risky, given that Gaskill warned me to stay away from the area only yesterday. But I'm feeling dispirited about ever recalling what happened on Saturday. A few hours of admittedly, hardly exhaustive, internet research this afternoon confirmed what I suspected. Hypnosis is not generally useful in retrieving hours lost to blackout because, as my previous reading suggested, we do not make memories during blackout. There is nothing to remember. It is, will always be, a black hole in my timeline.
Megan. Thursday, the 7th of March, 2013. Afternoon. The room is dark, the air close, sweet with the smell of us. We're at the Swan again, in the room under the eaves. It's different, though, because he's still here, watching me. "Where do you want to go?" he asks me. "A house on the beach, on the Costa de la Luz," I tell him. He smiles. "What will we do?" I laugh. You mean apart from this? His fingers are tracing slowly over my belly.
Apart from this?
We'll open a cafe, show art, learn to surf. He kisses me on the tip of my hip bone.
What about Thailand? He says.
I wrinkle my nose. Too many gap year kids.
Sicily, I say.
The Igardi Islands. We'll open a beach bar. Go fishing. He laughs again and then moves his body up over mine and kisses me.
Irresistible, he mumbles. You're irresistible.
I want to laugh. I want to say it out loud.
See, I win. I told you it wasn't the last time. It's never the last time.
I bite my lip, close my eyes. I was right. I knew I was, but it wouldn't do me any good to say it.
I enjoy my victory silently. I take pleasure in it, almost as much as in his touch.
Afterwards, he talks to me in a way he hasn't done before. Usually I'm the one doing all the talking, but this time he opens up. He talks about feeling empty, about the family he left behind, about the woman before me and the one before that, the one who wrecked his head and left him hollow. I don't believe in soulmates, but there's an understanding between us which I just haven't felt before, or at least not for a long time. It comes from shared experience, from knowing how it feels to be broken. Hollowness. That I understand. I'm starting to believe that there isn't anything you can do to fix it. That's what I've taken from the therapy sessions. The holes in your life are permanent. You have to grow around them like tree roots around concrete. You mold yourself through the gaps. All these things I know, but I don't say them out loud. Not now. When will we go? I ask him, but he doesn't answer me. And I fall asleep. And he's gone when I wake up. Friday the 8th of March, 2013. Morning. Scott brings me coffee on the terrace.
You slept last night, he says, bending down to kiss my head.
He's standing behind me, hands on my shoulders, warm and solid. I lean my head back against his body, close my eyes and listen to the train rumbling along the track until it stops just in front of the house. When we first moved here, Scott used to wave at the passengers, which always made me laugh. His grip tightens a little on my shoulders. He leans forward and kisses my neck.
You slept, he says again. You must be feeling better.
I am, I say.
Do you think it's worked then? He asks.
The therapy. I think I'm fixed, do you mean?
Not fixed, he says, and I can hear the hurt in his voice. I didn't mean...
I know. I lift my hand to his and squeeze. I was only joking. I think it's a process. It's not simple, you know? I don't know if there will be a time when I can say that it's worked, that I'm better. There's a silence, and he grips just a little harder.
So you want to keep going? He asks, and I tell him I do.
There was a time when I thought he could be everything. He could be enough. I thought that for years. I loved him completely. I still do, but I don't want this any longer. The only time I feel like me is on those secret, febrile afternoons like yesterday, when I come alive in all that heat and half-light. Who's to say that once I run, I'll find that isn't enough? Who's to say I won't end up feeling exactly the way I do now? Not safe. But stifled. Maybe I'll want to run again, and again, and eventually I'll end up back by those old tracks, because there's nowhere left to go. Maybe. Maybe not. You have to take the risk, don't you? I go downstairs to say goodbye as he's heading off to work. He slips his arms around my waist and kisses the top of my head.
Love you, Megs,
he murmurs, and I feel horrible then. Like the worst person in the world. I can't wait for him to shut the door, because I know I'm going to cry.
Rachel. Friday the 19th of July, 2013. Morning. The 804 is almost deserted. The windows are open, and the air is cool after yesterday's storm. Megan has been missing for around 133 hours, and I feel better than I have in months. When I looked at myself in the mirror this morning, I could see the difference in my face. My skin is clearer, my eyes brighter. I feel lighter. I'm sure I haven't actually lost an ounce, but I don't feel encumbered. I feel like myself, the myself I used to be. There's been no word from Scott. I scoured the internet and there was no news of an arrest either, so I imagine he just ignored my email. I'm disappointed, but I suppose it was to be expected. Gaskill rang this morning, just as I was leaving the house. He asked me whether I would be able to come by the station today. I was terrified for a moment, but then I heard him say in his quiet, mild tone that he just wanted me to look at a couple of pictures. I asked him whether Scott Hipwell had been arrested.
"No one has been arrested, Miss Watson," he said.
"But the man? The one who's under caution?"
"I'm not at liberty to say."
His manner of speaking is so calming, so reassuring, it makes me like him again. I spent yesterday evening sitting on the sofa in jogging bottoms and a T-shirt, making lists of things to do, possible strategies. For example, I could hang around Whitney Station at rush hour, wait until I see the red-haired man from Saturday night again. I could invite him for a drink and see where it leads, whether he saw anything, what he knows about that night. The danger is that I might see Anna or Tom. They would report me, and I would get into trouble, more trouble, with the police. The other danger is that I might make myself vulnerable. I still have the trace of an argument in my head. I may have physical evidence of it on my scalp and lip. What if this is the man who hurt me? The fact that he smiled and waved doesn't mean anything. He could be a psychopath for all I know. But I can't see him as a psychopath. I can't explain it, but I warm to him. I could contact Scott again, but I need to give him a reason to talk to me. And I'm worried that whatever I say will make me look like a madwoman. He might even think I had something to do with Megan's disappearance. He could report me to the police. I could end up in real trouble. I could try hypnosis. I'm pretty sure it won't help me remember anything, but I'm curious about it anyway. It can't hurt, can it? I was still sitting there making notes and going over the news stories I'd printed out when Kathy came home. She'd been to the cinema with Damien. She was obviously pleasantly surprised to find me sober, but she was wary, too, because we haven't really spoken since the police came round on Tuesday. I told her that I hadn't had a drink for 3 days, and she gave me a hug.
"I'm so glad you're getting yourself back to normal," she chirruped,
as though she knows what my baseline is. "That thing with the police," I said. "It was a misunderstanding. There's no problem with me and Tom, and I don't know anything about that missing girl. You don't have to worry about it." She gave me another hug and made us both a cup of tea. I thought about taking advantage of the goodwill I'd engendered and telling her about the job situation, but I didn't want to spoil her evening. She was still in a good mood with me this morning. She hugged me again as I was getting ready to leave the house.
"I'm so pleased for you, Rach," she said, "getting yourself sorted. You've had me worried."
Then she told me that she was going to spend the weekend at Damien's, and the first thing I thought is that I'm going to get home tonight and have a drink without anyone judging me. Evening. The bitter tang of quinine. That's what I love about a cold gin and tonic. Tonic water should be by Schweppes, and it should come out of a glass bottle, not a plastic one. These pre-mixed things aren't right at all, but needs must. I know I shouldn't be doing this, but I've been building up to it all day. It's not just the anticipation of solitude, though. It's the excitement, the adrenaline. I'm buzzing, my skin is tingling. I've had a good day. I spent an hour alone with Detective Inspector Gaskill this morning. I was taken in to see him straight away when I arrived at the station. We sat in his office, not in the interview room this time. He offered me coffee, and when I accepted, I was surprised to find that he got up and made it for me himself. He had a kettle and some Nescafe on top of a fridge in the corner of the office. He apologized for not having sugar. I liked being in his company. I liked watching his hands move. He isn't expressive, but he moves things around a lot. I hadn't noticed this before because in the interview room there wasn't much for him to move around. Here, in his office, he constantly altered the position of his coffee mug, his stapler, a jar of pens. He shuffled papers into neater piles. He has large hands and long fingers with neatly manicured nails. No rings. It felt different this morning. I didn't feel like a suspect, someone he was trying to catch out. I felt useful. I felt most useful when he took one of his folders and laid it in front of me, showing me a series of photographs. Scott Hipwell, three men I'd never seen before, and then B. I wasn't sure at first. I stared at the picture, trying to conjure up the image of the man I saw with her that day, his head bent as he stooped to embrace her. "That's him," I said. "I think that's him."
"You're not sure?"
"I think that's him." He withdrew the picture and scrutinized it himself for a moment.
"You saw them kissing, that's what you said. Last Friday, was it? A week ago?"
"Yes, that's right. Friday morning. They were outside in the garden."
"And there's no way you could have misinterpreted what you saw? It wasn't a hug, say, or a platonic kind of kiss?"
"No, it wasn't. It was a proper kiss. It was romantic." I thought I saw his lips flicker then, as though he were about to smile. "Who is he?" I asked Gaskill. "Is he... do you think she's with him?" He didn't reply, just shook his head a little. "Is this... have I helped? Have I been helpful at all?"
"Yes, Miss Watson. You've been helpful. Thank you for coming in."
We shook hands, and for a second, he placed his left hand on my right shoulder lightly, and I wanted to turn and kiss it. It's been a while since anyone touched me with anything approaching tenderness. Well, apart from Kathy. Gaskill ushered me out of the door and into the main open-plan part of the office. There were perhaps a dozen police officers in there. One or two shot me sideways glances. There might have been a flicker of interest or disdain, I couldn't be sure. We walked through the office and into the corridor, and then I saw him walking towards me, with Riley at his side. Scott Hipwell. He was coming through the main entrance. His head was down, but I knew right away that it was him. He looked up and nodded an acknowledgement to Gaskill. Then he glanced at me. For just a second, our eyes met, and I could swear that he recognized me. I thought of that morning when I saw him on the terrace, when he was looking down at the track, when I could feel him looking at me. We passed each other in the corridor. He was so close to me, I could have touched him. He was beautiful in the flesh, hollowed out and coiled like a spring, nervous energy radiating off him. As I got to the main hallway, I turned to look at him. Sure, I could feel his eyes on me. But when I looked back, it was Riley who was watching me. I took the train into London and went to the library. I read every article I could find about the case, but learned nothing more. I looked for hypnotherapists in Ashbury, but didn't take it any further. It's expensive, and it's unclear whether it actually helps with memory recovery. But reading the stories of those who claimed that they had recovered memories through hypnotherapy, I realized that I was more afraid of success than failure. I'm afraid not just of what I might learn about that Saturday night, but so much more. I'm not sure I could bear to relive the stupid, awful things I've done. To hear the words I said in spite. To remember the look on Tom's face as I said them. I'm too afraid to venture into that darkness.
I thought about sending Scott another email, but there's really no need. The morning's meeting with Detective Inspector Gaskill proved to me that the police are taking me seriously. I have no further role to play. I have to accept that now. And I can feel at least that I may have helped, because I cannot believe it could be a coincidence that Megan disappeared the day after I saw her with that man. With a joyful click, fizz, I opened the second can of G&T and realised with a rush that I haven't thought about Tom all day. Until now, anyway. I've been thinking about Scott, about Gaskill, about B, about the man on the train. Tom has been relegated to fifth place. I sip my drink and feel that at last I have something to celebrate. I know that I'm going to be better, that I'm going to be happy. It won't be long. Saturday, the 20th of July, 2013. Morning. I never learn. I wake with a crushing sensation of wrongness, of shame, and I know immediately that I've done something stupid. I go through my awful, achingly familiar ritual of trying to remember exactly what I did. I sent an email. That's what it was. At some point last night, Tom got promoted back up the list of men I think about, and I sent him an email. My laptop is on the floor next to my bed. It sits there, a squat, accusatory presence. I step over it as I get up to go to the bathroom. I drink water directly from the tap, giving myself a cursory glance in the mirror. I don't look well. Still, 3 days off isn't bad, and I'll start again today. I stand in the shower for ages, gradually reducing the water temperature, making it cooler and cooler until it's properly cold. You can't step directly into a cold stream of water. It's too shocking, too brutal. But if you get there gradually, you hardly notice it. It's like boiling a frog in reverse. The cool water soothes my skin. It dulls the burning pain of the cuts on my head and above my eye. I take my laptop downstairs and make a cup of tea. There's a chance, a faint one, that I wrote an email to Tom and didn't send it. I take a deep breath and open my Gmail account. I'm relieved to see I have no messages, but when I click on the sent folder, there it is. I have written to him. He just hasn't replied. Yet. The email was sent just after 11 last night. I'd been drinking for a good few hours by then. That adrenaline and booze bars I had earlier on would have been long gone. I click on the message. Could you please tell your wife to stop lying to the police about me? Pretty low, don't you think? Trying to get me into trouble. Telling police I'm obsessed with her and her ugly brat? She needs to get over herself. Tell her to leave me the fuck alone. I close my eyes and snap the laptop shut. I am cringing, literally, my entire body folding into itself. I want to be smaller. I want to disappear. I'm frightened, too, because if Tom decides to show this to the police, I could be in real trouble. If Anna is collecting evidence that I am vindictive and obsessive, this could be a key piece in her dossier. And why did I mention the little girl? What sort of person does that? What sort of person thinks like that? I don't bear her any ill will. I couldn't think badly of a child, any child, and especially not Tom's child. I don't understand myself. I don't understand the person I've become. God. He must hate me. I hate me. That version of me anyway, the version who wrote that email last night. She doesn't even feel like me because I am not like that. I am not hateful. Am I? I try not to think of the worst days, but the memories crowd into my head at times like this. Another fight, towards the end. Waking, post-party, post-blackout. Tom telling me how I'd been the night before, embarrassing him again, insulting the wife of a colleague of his, shouting at her for flirting with my husband. "I don't want to go anywhere with you anymore," he told me. You ask me why I never invite friends round, why I don't like going to the pub with you anymore. You honestly want to know why? It's because of you. Because I'm ashamed of you.
I pick up my handbag and my keys. I'm going to the Londis down the road. I don't care that it's not yet 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm frightened, and I don't want to have to think. If I take some painkillers and have a drink now, I can put myself out. I can sleep all day. I'll face it later. I get to the front door, my hand poised above the handle. Then I stop. I could apologize. If I apologize right now, I might be able to salvage something. I might be able to persuade him not to show the message to Anna or to the police. It wouldn't be the first time he'd protected me from her. That day, last summer, when I went to Tom and Anna's, it didn't happen exactly the way I told the police it had. I didn't ring the doorbell, for starters. I wasn't sure what I wanted. I'm still not sure what I intended. I did go down the pathway and over the fence. It was quiet. I couldn't hear anything. I went up to the sliding doors and looked in. It's true that Anna was sleeping on the sofa. I didn't call out to her or to Tom. I didn't want to wake her. The baby wasn't crying. She was fast asleep in her carry cot at her mother's side. I picked her up and took her outside as quickly as I could. I remember running with her towards the fence, the baby starting to wake and to grizzle a little. I don't know what I thought I was doing. I wasn't going to hurt her. I got to the fence, holding her tightly against my chest. She was crying properly now, starting to scream. I was bouncing her and shushing her, and then I heard another noise, a train coming. And I turned my back to the fence, and I saw her, Anna, hurtling towards me, her mouth open like a gaping wound, her lips moving, but I couldn't hear what she was saying. She took the child from me, and I tried to run away, but I tripped and fell. She was standing over me, screaming at me. She told me to stay put or she'd call the police. She rang Tom, and he came home and sat with her in the living room. She was crying hysterically. She still wanted to phone the police. She wanted to have me arrested for kidnapping. Tom calmed her down. He begged her to let it go, to let me go. He saved me from her. Afterwards, he drove me home, and when he dropped me off, he took my hand. I thought it was a gesture of kindness, of reassurance. But he squeezed tighter and tighter and tighter until I cried out, and his face was red when he told me that he would kill me if I ever did anything to harm his daughter. I don't know what I intended to do that day. I still don't. At the door, I hesitate, my fingers grasped around the handle. I bite down hard on my lip. I know that if I start drinking now, I will feel better for an hour or two, and worse for 6 or 7. I let go of the handle and walk back into the living room, and I open my laptop again. I have to apologize. I have to beg forgiveness. I log back into my email account and see that I have one new message. It isn't from Tom. It's from Scott Hipwell.
Dear Rachel, thank you for contacting me. I don't remember Megan mentioning you to me, but she had a lot of gallery regulars. I'm not very good with names. I would like to talk to you about what you know. Please telephone me on 07583-123-657 as soon as possible. Regards, Scott Hipwell.
For an instant, I imagined that he sent the email to the wrong address. This message is intended for someone else. It's just the briefest of moments. And then, I remember. I remember. Sitting on the sofa, halfway through the second bottle, I realized that I didn't want my part to be over. I wanted to be at the heart of it. So I wrote to him. I scrolled down from his email to mine. Dear Scott, sorry for contacting you again, but I feel it's important that we talk.
I'm not sure if Megan ever mentioned me to you. I'm a friend from the gallery. I used to live in Whitney. I think I have information that would interest you. Please email me back on this address. Rachel Watson. I can feel the heat come to my face. My stomach a pit of acid. Yesterday, sensible, clear-headed, right-thinking, I decided I must accept that my part in this story was over. But my better angels lost again, defeated by drink, by the person I am when I drink. Drunk Rachel sees no consequences. She's either excessively expansive and optimistic, or wrapped up in hate. She has no past, no future. She exists purely in the moment. Drunk Rachel, wanting to be part of the story, needing a way to persuade Scott to talk to her, she lied. I lied. I want to drag knives over my skin, just so that I can feel something other than shame. But I'm not even brave enough to do that. I start writing to Tom, writing and deleting, writing and deleting, trying to find ways to ask forgiveness for the things I said last night. If I had to write down every transgression for which I should apologize to Tom, I could fill a book. Evening. A week ago, almost exactly a week ago, Megan Hipwell walked out of number 15 Blenheim Road and disappeared. No one has seen her since. Neither her phone nor her bank cards have been used since Saturday either. When I read that in a news story earlier today, I started to cry. I am ashamed now of the secret thoughts I had. Megan is not a mystery to be solved. She's not a figure who wanders into the tracking shot at the beginning of a film, beautiful, ethereal, insubstantial. She's not a cipher. She is real. I am on the train, and I'm going to her home. I'm going to meet her husband. I had to phone him. The damage was done. I couldn't just ignore the email. He would tell the police, wouldn't he? I would, in his position, if a stranger contacted me claiming to have information and then disappeared. He might have called the police already. They might be waiting for me when I get there. Sitting here, in my usual seat, though not on my usual day, I feel as though I am driving off a cliff. It felt the same this morning when I dialed his number. Like falling through the dark, not knowing when you're going to hit the ground. He spoke to me in a low voice, as though there was someone else in the room, someone he didn't want to overhear.
"Can we talk in person?"
he asked.
No. I don't think so. Please.
I hesitated just for a moment, and then I agreed.
"Could you come to the house?"
"Not now, there are people here. This evening?" He gave me the address, which I pretended to note down.
"Thank you for contacting me,"
he said. And he hung up. I knew, as I was agreeing, that it wasn't a good idea. What I know about Scott, from the papers, is almost nothing. What I know from my own observations, I don't really know. I don't know anything about Scott. I know things about Jason, who, I have to keep reminding myself, doesn't exist. All I know for sure, for absolutely certain, is that Scott's wife has been missing for a week. I know that he is probably a suspect. And I know, because I saw that kiss, that he has a motive to kill her. Of course, he might not know that he has a motive, but... Oh, I've tied myself up in knots thinking about it. But how could I pass up the opportunity to approach that house? The one I've observed 100 times from the trackside, from the street. To walk up to his front door, to go inside, to sit in his kitchen, on his terrace, where they sat, where I watched them. It was too tempting. Now, I sit on the train, my arms wrapped around myself, hands jammed against my sides to stop them from trembling, like an excited child caught up in an adventure.
I was so glad to have a purpose that I stopped thinking about the reality. I stopped thinking about Megan. I'm thinking about her now. I have to convince Scott that I knew her. A little. Not a lot. That way, he'll believe me when I tell him that I saw her with another man. If I admit to lying right away, he'll never trust me. So I tried to imagine what it would have been like to drop by the gallery, chat with her over a coffee. Does she drink coffee? We would talk about art, perhaps, or yoga, or our husbands. I don't know anything about art. I've never done yoga. I don't have a husband. And she betrayed hers. I think of the things her real friends said about her. Wonderful, funny, beautiful, warm-hearted, loved. She made a mistake. It happens. We are none of us perfect.
Anna. Saturday, the 20th of July, 2013. Morning. Evie wakes just before 6. I get out of bed, slip into the nursery and pick her up. I feed her and take her back to bed with me. When I wake again, Tom's not at my side, but I can hear his footfalls on the stairs. He's singing low and tuneless. I hadn't even thought about it earlier. I'd completely forgotten. I didn't think of anything but fetching my little girl and getting back to bed. Now I'm giggling before I'm even properly awake. I open my eyes and Evie's smiling too. And when I look up, Tom's standing at the foot of the bed holding a tray. He's wearing my Orla Keely apron and nothing else. "Breakfast in bed, birthday girl," he says. He places the tray at the end of the bed and scoots round to kiss me. I open my presents. I have a pretty silver bracelet with onyx inlay from Evie, and a black silk teddy and matching knickers from Tom. And I can't stop smiling. He climbs back into bed, and we lie with Evie between us. She has her fingers curled tightly around his forefinger, and I have hold of her perfect pink foot. And I feel as though fireworks are going off in my chest. It's impossible, this much love. A while later, when Evie gets bored of lying there, I get her up and we go downstairs and leave Tom to snooze. He deserves it. I pot around, tidying up a bit. I drink my coffee outside on the patio, watching the half-empty trains rattle past, and think about lunch. It's hot. Too hot for a roast. But I'll do one anyway, because Tom loves roast beef. And we can have ice cream afterwards to cool us down. I just need to pop out to get that Merlot he likes. So I get Evie ready, strap her in the buggy, and we stroll down to the shops. Everyone told me I was insane to agree to move into Tom's house. But then everyone thought I was insane to get involved with a married man, let alone a married man whose wife was highly unstable. And I've proved them wrong on that one. No matter how much trouble she causes, Tom and Evie are worth it. But they were right about the house. On days like today, with the sun shining, when you walk down our little street, tree-lined and tidy, not quite a cul-de-sac, but with the same sense of community, it could be perfect. Its pavements are busy with mothers just like me, with dogs on leads and toddlers on scooters. It could be ideal. It could be, if you weren't able to hear the screeching brakes of the trains. It could be, so long as you didn't turn around and look back down towards number 15. When I get back, Tom is sitting at the dining room table, looking at something on the computer. He's wearing shorts but no shirt. I can see the muscles moving under his skin when he moves. It still gives me butterflies to look at him. I say hello, but he's in a world of his own, and when I wrung my fingertips over his shoulder, he jumps. The laptop snaps shut. "Hey," he says, getting to his feet. He's smiling, but he looks tired, worried. He takes Evie from me without looking me in the eye. "What?" I ask. "What is it?" "Nothing," he says, and he turns away towards the window, bouncing Evie on his hip. "Tom, what?" "It's nothing." He turns back and gives me a look, and I know what he's going to say before he says it. "Rachel. Another email." He shakes his head, and he looks so wounded, so upset, and I hate it. I can't bear it. Sometimes I want to kill that woman. What she said. He just shakes his head again. It doesn't matter. It's just the usual bullshit. I'm sorry, I say, and I don't ask what bullshit exactly, because I know he won't want to tell me. He hates upsetting me with this stuff. It's okay. It's nothing. Just the usual pissed nonsense. God, is she ever going to go away? Is she ever going to just let us be happy? He comes over to me, and with our daughter between us, kisses me. We are happy, he says. We are. Evening. We are happy. We had lunch and lay out on the lawn, and then when it got too hot, we came inside and ate ice cream while Tom watched the Grand Prix. Evie and I made Play-Doh, and she ate quite a bit of that too. I think about what's going on down the road, and I think about how lucky I am, how I got everything that I wanted. When I look at Tom, I thank God that he found me too, that I was there to rescue him from that woman. She'd have driven him mad in the end, I really think that. She'd have ground him down, she'd have made him into something he's not. Tom's taken Evie upstairs to give her a bath. I can hear her squealing with delight from here, and I'm smiling again. The smile has barely fallen from my lips all day. I do the washing up, tidy up the living room, think about dinner. Something light. It's funny, because a few years ago, I would have hated the idea of staying in and cooking on my birthday. But now it's perfect. It's the way it should be. Just the three of us. I pick up Evie's toys, scattered around the living room floor, and return them to their trunk. I'm looking forward to putting her down early tonight, to slipping into that teddy Tom bought me. It won't be dark for hours yet, but I light the candles on the mantelpiece and open the second bottle of Merlot to let it breathe. I'm just leaning over the sofa to pull the curtain shut when I see a woman, her head bent to her chest, scuttling along the pavement on the opposite side of the street. She doesn't look up, but it's her. I'm sure of it. I lean further forward, my heart hammering in my chest, trying to get a better look, but the angle's wrong, and I can't see her now. I turn, ready to bolt out of the front door to chase her down the street, but Tom's standing there in the doorway, Evie wrapped in a towel in his arms.
Are you okay? He asks. What's wrong?
Nothing, I say, stuffing my hands into my pockets so that he can't see them shaking. Nothing's wrong. Nothing at all.
Rachel. Sunday, the 21st of July, 2013. Morning. I wake with my head full of him. It doesn't seem real. None of it does. My skin prickles. I would dearly love to have a drink, but I can't. I need to keep a clear head for Megan, for Scott. I made an effort yesterday. I washed my hair and put some makeup on. I wore the only jeans I still fit into, with a cotton print blouse and sandals with a low heel. I looked okay. I kept telling myself that it was ridiculous to care about my appearance, because the last thing Scott was going to be thinking about was what I looked like. But I couldn't help myself. It was the first time I was ever going to be around him. It mattered to me. Much more than it should. I took the train, leaving Ashbury around 6:30, and I was in Whitney just after 7. I took that walk along Rosebery Avenue, past the underpass. I didn't look this time. Couldn't bear to. I hurried past number 23, Tom and Anna's place, chinned chest and sunglasses on, praying they wouldn't see me. It was quiet, no one around. A couple of cars driving carefully down the centre of the road between ranks of parked vehicles. It's a sleepy little street, tidy and affluent, with lots of young families. They're all having their dinner around 7 o'clock, or sitting on the sofa, mum and dad with the little ones squeezed between them, watching X Factor. From number 23 to number 15 can't be more than 50 or 60 paces. But that journey stretched out. It seemed to take an age. My legs were leaden, my footing unsteady, as though I were drunk, as though I might just slip off the pavement. Scott opened the door almost before I'd finished knocking. My trembling hand still raised as he appeared in the doorway, looming ahead of me, filling the space.
"Rachel?"
he asked, looking down at me, unsmiling. I nodded. He offered his hand, and I took it. He gestured for me to enter the house, but for a moment, I didn't move. I was afraid of him. Up close, he is physically intimidating, tall and broad-shouldered, his arms and chest well-defined. His hands are huge. It crossed my mind that he could crush me, my neck, my ribcage, without much effort. I moved past him into the hallway, my arm brushing against his as I did, and felt a flush rising to my face. He smelled of old sweat, and his dark hair was matted against his head as though he hadn't showered in a while. It was in the living room that the déjà vu hit me, so strong it was almost frightening. I recognized the fireplace flanked by alcoves on the far wall, the way the light streamed in from the street through slanted blinds. I knew that when I turned to my left, there would be glass and green, and beyond that the railway line. I turned, and there was the kitchen table, the French doors behind it, and the lush patch of lawn. I knew this house. I felt dizzy. I wanted to sit down. I thought about that black hole last Saturday night, all those lost hours. It didn't mean anything, of course. I know that house, but not because I've been there. I know it because it's exactly the same as number 23. A hallway leads to the stairs, and on the right-hand side is the living room, not through into the kitchen. The patio and the garden are familiar to me because I've seen them from the train. I didn't go upstairs, but I know that if I had, there would have been a landing with a large sash window on it, and that if you climbed through that window, you would find yourself on the makeshift roof terrace. I know that there will be two bedrooms, the master with two large windows looking out onto the street, and a smaller room at the back, overlooking the garden. Just because I know that house inside and out does not mean that I've been there before. Still, I was trembling when Scott showed me into the kitchen. He offered me a cup of tea. I sat down at the kitchen table while he boiled the kettle, dropped a tea bag into a mug, and slopped boiling water over the counter, muttering to himself under his breath. There was a sharp smell of antiseptic in the room, but Scott himself was a mess. A sweat patch on the back of his t-shirt, his jeans hanging loose on his hips as though they were too big for him. I wondered when was the last time he had eaten. He placed the mug of tea in front of me and sat on the opposite side of the kitchen table, his hands folded in front of him. The silence stretched out, filling the space between us, the whole room. It rang in my ears, and I felt hot and uncomfortable, my mind suddenly blank. I didn't know what I was doing there. Why on earth had I come? In the distance, I heard a low rumbling. The train was coming. It felt comforting, that old sound.
"You're a friend of Megan's,"
he said at last. Hearing her name from his lips brought a lump to my throat. I stared down at the table, my hands wrapped tightly around the mug. "Yes," I said. "I know her. A little. From the gallery." He looked at me, waiting, expectant. I could see the muscle flex in his jaw as he clenched his teeth. I searched for words that wouldn't come. I should have prepared better. "Have you had any news?" I asked. His gaze held mine, and for a second, I felt afraid. I'd said the wrong thing. It was none of my business whether there was any news. He would be angry. He'd ask me to leave.
"No," he said. "What was it that you wanted to tell me?"
The train rolled slowly past,
and I looked out towards the tracks. I felt dizzy, as though I were having an out-of-body experience, as though I were looking out at myself.
You said in your email that you wanted to tell me something about